In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these are the years we refer to as the Golden Age of Radio.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing it yourself.
Hal Kemp, on the air for Griffin.
It's time to shine. Shine your shoes anyway.
Tony Home Permanent presents...
This is Nora Drake.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889. We'll join Dick Bertel, Ed Corcoran, and their special guest in just a moment. But first, be a payday saver at the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Go into any office of Burritt on the first day, last day, 15th day, or any day of the month, and you will meet a select group of savers, the payday savers, businessmen, tradesmen, professional people, career girls, and even mothers who save from the grocery money. Why do these people all stop in at the Big B? To save on a regular and very profitable basis. A payday saver is a regular saver. A saver who knows that only through a systematic plan of savings will he be able to pay for that college education, new home, or retirement trip around the world. At the Burritt, the payday saver receives 5% on a regular account with interest from day of deposit to day of withdrawal, 6% on 2-year certificates of deposit, 5.75% on 1-year certificates, and 5.25% on 90-day notice accounts. Join your friends at the sign of the Big B, the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, and become a payday saver. Deposits insured by FDIC. And now the host of the Golden Age of Radio, Dick Bertel. Good evening. And with me once again to share this hour of memories with you is Ed Corcoran, the man with 2,500 hours of old-time radio shows on tape. Ed, that collection of yours is beginning to grow.
Yes, it's going by leaps and bounds. I must add about 3 hours a week, Dick. No problems at all.
Well, we're going to be able to share some of those memories tonight because our guest was a well-known writer during the Golden Age of Radio and contributed to most of the big programs that we remember, if not all at one time or another. Noel Gerson, well-known writer and author of some 10,000 radio programs. First of all, I want to remind our listeners that you make your home in Clinton, Connecticut. They know the name, I'm sure, because they have had the opportunity to read many of your books, the latest of which is Because I Loved Him, the story of Lily Langtry. And that's a delightful story. How's the book going?
Going very well, I'm delighted to say, available in bookstores everywhere.
Published by William Morrow?
Right.
All right. Ed, how far back does Noel's career take us?
Well, you started, I believe, in Chicago, wasn't it, around 1936, 37?
You got a good memory. I started in 37 as news director for WGN in Chicago and doubling as a news and special events director for the old Mutual Broadcasting System, which we and WOR in New York jointly owned. Eventually, in 39, right after World War II started in Europe, I moved from news and special events to become the program director and vice president of GN and of the network.
And, of course, you were writing all the while.
Well, not really all the while. I started doing dramatic shows, which I'd always wanted to do. I started doing them after I took over as program vice president for two reasons. One was it was very difficult to find somebody to fit this or that format, usually in a hurry, so I did it myself. And the other reason, ostensibly was because I could pay myself less and save money on the budget. My real reason was that I wanted to get the exposure and wanted to build up a name as a dramatic writer.
Let's talk just a bit, if we may, about the setup of the Mutual Broadcasting System. It was the fourth network in many senses, wasn't it?
It was very much the fourth network. We were way behind the others. We had by far the most number of stations. We had 400-odd stations in those days. But they were all in on a co-op basis, so that if our sales department tried to get time for a national program, well, Omaha would say, no, we can't come in, and Boston couldn't come in because they all had local programs. So we had to scrabble around and build a basic network of New York, Chicago, Boston, Washington, Los Angeles, maybe a dozen big cities, and then as many of the smaller communities as we could get to come in would come in on a program. And it was a matter of did the tail wag the dog or did the dog wag the tail, because we couldn't get the stations to come in unless we had big shows, and we couldn't get big shows unless we had the stations. So it was a long, hard struggle, and by 1939, which is when I took over, the pioneer work had been done, and we were able to begin to put on the big dramatic and the big musical shows with big-name stars that therefore attracted an audience.
Well, it was one show that was very well remembered from that period, Chicago Theater of the Year. That was one of your shows that you were personally associated with, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I wrote, I'd say, about over a two-year period before I went into the Army, I wrote about 50 of them, which means that I wrote approximately one every other week.
What was the show like? Could you just recall a little bit about it for us?
Oh, I can recall a great deal of it. We were an hour-and-a-half program. We started with adaptations, usually of musicals, although sometimes we did plays. We did musicals like Irene
or
some of the Victor Herbert stuff, any number of them. And occasionally, if I had a very, very good idea that I could get through the front office, we would then put on an original. The originals, I hasten to add, were all straight dramatic plays or comedies. They were not musicals, because to do a musical, an original musical in those days just for radio would have been exorbitant and impossible.
Not only were you the writer of that show, but you were in a sense the producer. I'm thinking of the many times that you had to corral a star in order to appear on that program when he or she happened to be in Chicago.
Yes, well, I was listed as the co-producer of the program, which simply meant that because I had personal connections in that my father was general manager for the Schuberts, I knew in advance very often when a star would be coming to Chicago. And I was commuting back and forth between Chicago and New York every week, as all executives of the network were doing, and I would dash into New York, would race over to see Star X or Star Y, and would get them signed up for us so that we could then begin to prepare for his or her appearance 3 months later. And of course, we had everybody from Tallulah Bankhead and Katharine Hepburn and all the big stars right up and down the line, because everybody sooner or later either came to Chicago or came through Chicago.
Be a payday saver at the Big B, Barrett Mutual Savings Bank. Come into any office of Barrett on any day of the month and meet a select group of savers. The payday savers, businessmen, tradesmen, professional people, career girls, yes, and even mothers who save from the grocery money. Why do these people all stop in at the Big B? To save on a regular and very profitable basis. A payday saver is a regular saver, one who knows that through a systematic plan of savings, he will be able to pay for that college education, new home, or retirement trip. At the Barrett, the payday saver receives 5% on a regular account with interest from day of deposit to day of withdrawal, 6% on two-year certificates of deposit, 5.75% on one-year certificates, and 5.25% on 90-day notice accounts. Join your friends at the sign of the Big B, the Barrett Mutual Savings Bank, and become a payday saver.
And now, Noel Gerson, I wonder if you'd tell us of your experiences at WLW in Cincinnati, the superpower station.
Oh, WLW was a marvelous experience. They were one of the, and are still today, one of the big 50,000-watt stations. Of course, 50,000 watts is the limit allowed by the Federal Communications Commission for the power of any radio station, including WTIC. And WLW, however, was granted an experimental permit to do to try 500,000-watt broadcasting. And that is an experience I'll never forget. I went down there for about a week or 10 days. They had some handsome old iron lampposts all over town in the older parts of town. And as you walked through, I went out to lunch the first day I was there, and the general manager of their station said to me, "Now listen to this." And we walked up to a lamppost, and here was WLW coming in loud and clear. Well, that part was all right, but they told me that they had an awful lot of trouble because of people with false teeth who had any metal in their false teeth. They were getting WLW day and night in their heads, and there wasn't anything they could do about it.
I heard stories that light bulbs actually glowed in Cincinnati near the transmitter because of the immense amount of power they were putting out.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And also, I am told I didn't see this myself, so I hope people aren't going to write in and say this was impossible, but I was told at the time that flashlights turned themselves on.
We're going to turn on some flashlights in the minds of our listeners now with one of the shows that you wrote at one time, Noel, Cavalcade of America.
That was one of the prestige shows. It was sponsored by DuPont, and was a very, very fancy program indeed. We tried to get big stars. We had a very slick production on it, and it was a good show because they gave a writer his head. They let you really try to write in depth, which is what most radio programs didn't do. Most of them were slick surface stuff, and Cavalcade really tried to let you let loose and do your best, and this was true right down the line with their production. They had intelligent, imaginative directors. They used good actors, and they gave their actors their heads. And it was a program, I'm sure, that any Cavalcade or most Cavalcade programs, if you were to put them on the air today from beginning to end, they would hold up remarkably well a good quarter of a century later.
Well, let's listen then to Cavalcade of America. Ed, who stars in this performance?
Well, we have two very famous stars. One is Arthur Shields, who was the brother of Barry Fitzgerald, and the other is Charles Lawton. The title of the show, incidentally, is Grandpa and the Statue.
Charles Lawton stars in Grandpa and the Statue, a warm human story of the most famous pinup girl in the world, on the Cavalcade of America, sponsored by the DuPont Company, maker of better things for better living through chemistry. Better things that include DuPont nylon, DuPont cellophane, DuPont plastic. The soldiers coming back from overseas strain their eyes through the mists of New York Harbor. And then their eyes light up when they see her. She's a handsome, statuesque lady whose figure is still beautiful, although this year she is celebrating her 59th birthday. She's the Statue of Liberty, and tonight's Cavalcade play is written about her. About her and a crusty old gent from Brooklyn named Monahan, who learned to love her. Charles Lawton is our star tonight in another of the roles that have made him one of our favorites. The DuPont Cavalcade presents Charles Lawton as Monahan in Grandpa and the Statue.
Good afternoon to you, Monahan.
How is she and how are you?
Fair, fair. And how's Mrs. Monahan these times?
Warm, same as everybody else in summer.
I've come to talk to you about the fund, Monahan.
What fund is that?
The Statue of Liberty Fund.
Oh, that.
It's time for us to come to grips with the subject, Monahan.
I am not interested, Ian.
Hold on for a minute. Let me tell you the fact. This here Frenchman has gone and built a fine Statue of Liberty. It cost the Lord knows how many thousands to build. All they're asking us to do is to contribute enough to put up a base for the statue to stand on.
I am not interested.
No, before you answer me. People all over the whole United States are putting in for it. Butler Street is doing the same. And we'd like to hang up a flag on the street corner saying, Butler Street, Brooklyn is 100% behind the Statue of Liberty. And Butler Street is 100% subscribed, except for you. Now, will you give us a dime, Monahan? One dime and we can put up the flag?
I am not throwing the good money away for something I don't even know exists.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Have you seen this statue?
No, but it's in a warehouse. And as soon as we get the money to build the pedestal, we'll take it and put it up on that island in the river. And all the boats coming from the old country will see it there. And it'll raise the hearts of the poor immigrants to see such a fine sight on a first look at the country.
And how do I know that it's in this warehouse at all?
You read your paper, don't you? It's been in all the papers for the past year.
The papers? Last year I read in the paper they were about to pave Butler Street and take out all the holes. Would you turn around and look at Butler Street, Mr. Sheehan?
All right, I'll do this. I'll show you the statue. Will you give me a dime, Dan?
Well, I am not saying that I would, and I am not saying that I would not. But I'd be more likely to if I saw the thing as large as life. I would.
All right, then. I'll take you to the warehouse. Come along. Now then, do you see the Statue of Liberty, or don't you see it?
I see it all right, but it's all broke.
Broke? They brought it from France on a boat. They had to take it apart, didn't they?
You got a second-hand statue. That's what you've got. And I'm not paying for a new one when they've shipped us something that's all smashed to pieces.
Now, just a minute, just a minute.
What's that over there?
Where?
That tablet there in her hand. What's it say? I put on my spectacles. July, IVMDCCLXXVI. What's all that?
That means July 4th, 1776. It's in Roman numbers. Oh, very high class.
What's the good of it? If they're going to put up a sign on her, they ought to put up Welcome All. That's it. Welcome All.
They decided July 4th, 1776, and July 4th, 1776 it's going to be.
All right, then. Let them get their dime from somebody else.
Monahan.
No, sir, I'll tell you something. I didn't think there was a statue, but there is. She's all broke, it's true. But she's here, and maybe they can get her together. But even if they do, will you tell me what sort of a welcome to emigrants it'll be? M.C.D.
All right, then, Monahan. I've heard everything now, Monahan. Just about everything. Goodbye.
What do you mean, goodbye? How am I to get back to Butler Street from here?
You've got legs to walk.
I'll remind you that I come on the trolley.
And I'll remind you that I paid your fare. And I'm not repeating the kindness.
Sheehan, you've stranded me.
Cavalcade of America. That brings back memories.
Do you know how being a preferred borrower at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank can help you? The other day, we asked a man who was waiting in the personal loan department if this were the first time that he had applied for a loan at the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. No, he said. It was actually the fourth. Now, why had he come back to the Burritt? Burritt was his bank. The loan officers were friendly and sympathetic to his needs, and they were willing to take the time to discuss his financial problems and help him. The rates are lower, he said. Monthly payments are convenient, and once he had established credit at the Burritt, he had become a preferred borrower, and his loans got top priority. Sound like a position you would like to be in? If so, drop in at any one of the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank's four convenient offices. You, too, may become a preferred Burritt borrower. The long-term benefits are tremendous.
And now let's continue with the story of Noel Gerson, the career that spans two decades at least, I guess, in radio and television. Let's jump over the war years now, because you did enter the service from WGN Chicago about 1941.
In 41, about 6 months before Pearl Harbor, and I had four glorious years in uniform.
And then you came out and went to New York.
I came to New York and started with a program called The Listening Post, which was sponsored by the Saturday Evening Post itself. And I did adaptations, five adaptations a week of stories and even articles from the Saturday Evening Post. We had a company of our own actors, the best people, literally, in the business. We had what we called a daytime show with a nighttime flavor. People like Everett Sloan, Myron McCormick, Ethel Owen, all the biggest names, the people who wouldn't appear on soap operas or on other daytime programs. In a sense, it was almost like a soap opera, except it was so much better because we had a different, completely different story every day.
Well, another very famous show of that period was Light of the World, and that was one of your favorites too, wasn't it, Noel?
It was one of my favorites for two reasons. We won a Peabody Award with it, and I wrote it for the better part of 6 years. That was the day-to-day story of the Bible. Well, we started, of course, at the beginning with Adam and Eve, and they were good for 26 weeks.
I can't believe that. 26 weeks.
But it held up.
You did much the same thing with King David.
He ran over a year.
Now, at the same time, you were writing David Harum. Did you ever become confused with your Davids by any chance?
I became very confused because during a portion of that period, I was also doing the alternate scripts. That is, I would do every other three-week segment on a program called Front Page Farrell, and his name was David.
What about the philosophy, or should we say the pseudo-philosophy of the writer of the 30s and 40s regarding the characters he created for radio?
Well, rather than have some of my old colleagues tar and feather me, I will not call it pseudo-philosophy from where they sat. I will just say I regarded it as strictly pseudo-philosophy, and I know there were a couple of others who did, too. It was pseudo because it was so off the cuff. It was so very fast with no depth. For instance, someone would look out of a window and say, you know, it looks as though it's going to rain. And the other character would say, well, there's real sunshine behind it, you know. True sunshine there because the sunshine of the spirit cuts through the fog, and so on and so on and so forth. And you could do this, you became so adept at turning out this kind of stuff that whenever you had to fill in 90 seconds on a program, somebody would philosophize based on the weather or based on food or based on any of the common things that we all know and experience together.
Well, you mentioned Front Page Farrell. And that was a Hummer production, wasn't it?
Yes, and so was David Harum. They were both Hummer shows.
And that was an experience in itself, wasn't it? The Hummers. Can you tell us a little about your dealings in those days?
Oh, yes, that was an extraordinary experience. I would go home and I would write an outline for the next six-week episode. We were divided into six-week episodes because that's the way Mr. and Mrs. Hummert wanted it, and what they wanted, they got. Then Mrs. Hummert would commune with her muse, and she would send this thing back corrected. And the way it had been corrected, that was the law of the living Lord, and that's the way you did it. And you observed all of their interior rules, which were countless. A leading man or a leading lady never smoked or never drank. When losing one's temper, it was lost in a ladies' or gentlemanly way. Actors never trampled on each other's lines. When actor A was speaking, actor B never came in. Each line was spoken clearly and emphatically. The foreign accents on these shows were almost non-existent. Everybody was American, of American birth. And most accents, most of the time, were the basic American Midwestern accent. You had very few regional accents coming in because they were afraid, and I suppose with some justification, that some people would think these things were caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
Of course, they carried it to violent extremes so that you could never have a German accent, an Italian accent, a French accent, or whatever on one of these shows. And this list was endless.
Well, you know, we laugh, but at one time, the Hummerts were responsible for almost 30% of all the radio programming we were listening to, so perhaps their formulas were successful. We just happen to have a Front Page Farrell. Would you like to hear it?
Oh, I would love to hear it.
Here is the exciting radio drama, Front Page Farrell, the unforgettable story of marriage and a newspaper office, the story of a handsome, dashing young star reporter on one of New York's greatest newspapers, and the girl he marries on impulse to save her from throwing herself away on a rich man twice her age. And now, Front Page Farrell. For several days, Sally Farrell has been busy making plans for the future, for she is determined that David, her newspaper reporter husband, shall be relieved of his dependence, meaning Sally herself, her mother, and her sister, and thus be able to enlist in the armed forces of his country. So far, her plans are not complete, but she has every hope of making them so in the next few days. At the moment, she's visiting with her next-door neighbors, Florence Schofield and her nephew, Leslie, in the little suburban village where Sally and David have recently moved.
You see, I didn't want to say anything about it to anyone before I had some idea that it could be managed. Since going to New York yesterday and talking to David's city editor, Tim O'Donovan, I feel ever so much encouraged.
You mean, Sally, that you want to get a job in some war production industry?
Yes, of course. But, my dear Sally, aren't you rushing into this without thinking it over carefully enough?
I know how I'd feel if I were in the same situation and it were Beverly who decided to go to work. Of course, that won't ever happen. Not to a man who's lame and not good for anything but modeling a few figures out of clay.
Oh, don't say that, Leslie. Your work is very important. You know it is.
How important is it at a time like this when the whole world is being torn apart?
It's important for us to keep things going at home, Leslie. I know you'll be famous someday.
Of course he will. Oh, Sally, the doctor's coming over later today to remove the bandage from Leslie's eyes.
Well, Leslie, that's wonderful. You've been awfully lucky in recovering so quickly.
I guess so.
Oh, you know perfectly well you have. And in just a few days now, you'll be well enough to start working again.
You know, Beverly is in love with you, Leslie.
How do you know?
She told me so.
Are you telling me the truth, Sally? You're not just making it up.
Oh, you know I wouldn't make it up.
You hear that, Aunt Flora?
Yes, Leslie, and I'm so glad for you.
Well, if that's true, then it changes everything. You know what I'm going to do the minute these bandages come off my eyes?
No, what?
I'm going to start back to work as I've never worked before. I'm going to ask Beverly to pose for me. Since you and she look enough alike to be sisters, I'm going to ask her to pose for me and finish the work that we began. Gee, it's going to be my best piece of sculpturing. If I hurry, I'll be able to get it in the exhibition.
Leslie, there's something I want to tell you.
Oh, it doesn't matter now, Sally. If only you knew how excited I am.
That's wonderful, Leslie, but...
Now I'm glad I started that particular piece of work. I can finish it with Beverly. Oh, this is too good to be true.
Leslie, you mustn't get yourself too excited. It may not be good for your eyes.
Oh, nonsense. Nothing matters now. Nothing at all. Well, why the silence? Aren't you going to say something?
I think perhaps I ought to be getting home.
So soon?
Well, it's later than I thought. There's so much to be done.
I'll see you to the door, my dear.
Right. Goodbye, Leslie.
Goodbye.
How am I going to tell Leslie the truth?
I think perhaps you'd better wait a day or so till he's a little stronger.
I hate to think of him looking forward to getting back to work on that statue, not knowing it smashed to bits. Not knowing that David smashed it after his fight with Leslie.
But it won't help him to know now.
Still, he'll have to know sometime.
Yes, of course, but...
Oh, if only it hadn't happened. I'd better go on home, but I'll be back later.
All right, Sally. And thank you so much for everything.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, dear.
Poor Leslie. He's going to feel so awful about this when he finds out. I wonder if he'll ever understand how it happened.
Sally?
Oh, David. When did you get home, darling?
Just a few minutes ago. I'm going to do some more of those special war articles for the newspaper. And Tim said I seem to get along better working here at home. And I guess he's right. Where have you been?
Next door. David, I'm so upset about Leslie.
Is he worse?
No, his eyes are much better. It's about his work.
What about it?
He told us he was going to finish the statue he started of me.
Oh, he doesn't know it's smashed?
No, and I didn't have the heart to tell him. David, I don't know how I ever will be able to tell him.
Well, tell him the truth, dear. Tell him I saw it sitting here on the living room table when I... got home after he'd stopped me and picked a fight, and that, well, I smashed it to bits. So here you are.
Leslie.
Schofield, what are you...
You're just the person I want to see, David Farrell.
Leslie, what are you doing here? Why have you taken the bandages off your arm?
Never mind about that. You didn't think I heard you when you and Aunt Florence were talking, did you?
What?
Well, I heard every word, Sally. I know what happened to my statue.
Leslie.
Your husband smashed
now,
it.
Now, just a minute.
Leslie.
You think you can get away with it, don't you?
Now, listen, Schofield.
I've said about enough from you, Farrell. And if you think you can smash the best piece of work I ever did, you're crazy, do you understand? Because this time you're not going to get away with it.
And so Leslie, in a fury of rage, has stormed over to the Farrell home, tearing the bandages from his eyes. What will follow upon his discovery of the truth? Will Sally and David be able to make him understand just what did happen? Front Page Farrell is on the air again at the same time Monday at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Wartime over this station. Be sure to listen. This is Bill Bond speaking for the makers of Anacin.
Farrell.
Front Page Farrell, going back many, many years, back to 1944, I guess. This is Dick Bertel. Along with me is Ed Corcoran, the man with 2,500 hours of old-time radio memories on tape. And our special guest from Clinton, Connecticut tonight is Noel B. Gerson, who is known, of course, today as an author, but who, in early life, to quote a soap opera, who in his youth was a remarkable radio writer and then, of course, subsequently, a television writer.
When looking for that new car, may we suggest that you come to the Barrett Mutual Savings Bank? No. The Big B does not sell new or used cars, but it does help people to buy them. Chances are that you didn't know that the Barrett Mutual Savings Bank will make you a car loan at low, low rates. Before buying that new car, call any one of our four convenient offices for information. But wait, that's not all. You will need another car when this one wears out. And the Big B has a plan for that, too. When you finish with your new car loan, keep on making the payments into a Barrett Mutual Savings account, where you will earn big, big dividends with no effort at all. Savings rates range from 5 to 6%, depending on the plan you choose. But whatever the plan, the next car you buy will be paid for by your Barrett Mutual Passbook. So don't wait. Drop in at any office of the Barrett Mutual Savings Bank for your new car loan or to make that monthly payment on your old car loan. Barrett Mutual Savings Bank.
You know, in listening to the soaps, as we have been with Front Page Farrell, I wondered, how much influence did the sponsor have on your script?
That depended completely on the program and on the advertising agency or the packaging firm that was doing the show. There were some shows, the shows of integrity, the Harvest of Stars that we did for McCann Erickson, that Jimmy Melton was hosting, and the sponsor not only had no voice, but wanted no voice in them. Mm-hmm. They left us strictly alone. They considered us to be people of integrity who knew our business. On the regular day-to-day romance of so-and-so, you very often found the sponsor or the sponsor's wife or the sponsor's cousin or somebody in the corporation would say, you know, I don't like that story. It seems to me they should be doing such and such. This would then be relayed to you, and you changed it.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever write Grand Central Station?
Oh, I sure did. That was a marvelous show. That was a series of Saturday morning original dramas, and there we had a complete carte blanche. We'd get together with the producer of the program, and very often with my friend Ira Ashley, who directed it from beginning to end and with whom I've reminisced about it not so long ago. And you'd sit down and you'd give him an idea for a show, and once you got the go-ahead, you would sit down and you would proceed to write the radio play. And it was left pretty much alone. If they felt you were a professional, in order to get variety into this thing, they didn't try to impose their ideas on you, but they gave you a free rein, with the result that the program, of course, was on the air for years and was highly successful. Only those shows, and here's a nice plea for free speech on the air, only those shows in which the professional writer was given his head and was allowed to do what he, as a professional, thought was right, within the program's basic limitations, of course, only such a show really survived, with one exception which disproves every word that I've now said. And that was The Lone Ranger.
And we'll talk about The Lone Ranger in just a moment, but Ed, we do have a Grand Central Station. Are you ready to give us that familiar opening?
Yes, this is one of the most famous themes in radio, not only the sound effects, but the words that go with it. And incidentally, there are two very famous radio actors in the cast, and maybe you'd like to mention who they are at the end of the excerpt, Noel.
If I can remember them.
I'm sure that you will.
All right.
Sheen cake flour and Pillsbury pancake flour bring you Grand Central Station.
As a bullet seeks its target, shining rails in every part of our great country are aimed at Grand Central Station, heart of the nation's greatest city.
Drawn by the magnetic force of the fantastic metropolis, day and night great trains rush toward the Hudson River, sweep down its eastern bank for 140 miles, flash briefly by the long red row of tenement houses south of 125th Street, dive with a roar into the 2.5 mile tunnel which burrows beneath the glitter and swank of Park Avenue, and then Grand Central Station, crossroads of a million private lives. Gigantic stage on which are played 1,000 dramas daily.
Down deep in the tunnels underneath Grand Central Station, through trains and locals arrive and depart with noisy regularity. But six stories above the street level, all is quiet and serene in the famous Grand Central Art Gallery. Polite visitors view the pictures and speak in hushed, well-modulated voices. But not Grandpa Gleason. He's probably the strangest, most eccentric, most outspoken art lover who's ever turned up his Yankee nose at the paintings. Standing now before a sunlit seascape, he snorts loudly and says to his granddaughter,
"Shucks, Irene. Who'd want a picture of just a hunk of the ocean? Ain't nothing in it but waves. Not very big waves at that."
"But, Gramp, it's really a wonderful painting. Look at the sunlight just hitting those flecks of foam and the..."
No, I don't like it. It's too realistic. Ain't got any artistic expression to it."
"But that's a Zachary."
"Oh, so it's a Zachary, huh? Well, listen, I was painting pictures when that young whippersnapper was still in three-cornered pans. And don't remind me that nobody ain't never bought one of my pictures, neither. Well, the world just don't appreciate me yet, that's all."
"Oh, I'm sure they will sometime, Grant."
Sometime. It appears to me they're taking a dead-burned, long-winded time about it. I ain't got no right to tie down a lively young girl like you. Now, ain't that so, Irene?
Oh.
You ought to be getting married to some young fella.
Oh, shh.
Sort of beginning a life of your..."
"Shh, Grant."
"Oh, I thought we was alone. Howdy, young fella."
"Oh, I'm sorry, sir. Would you mind stepping a bit to the left? I'd like to sketch that picture."
"Why, of course."
"You want to sketch this bunch of waves by Zachary?"
No, the painting just below it."
"Oh, that one. Well, that ain't no good neither. Just a lifeless picture of a couple of ships supposed to be in battle."
"Well, that happens to be just what I want at the moment."
"Why, you an artist, young fella?"
No, why?"
"Well, you look like one. You need a haircut."
"Grant."
"I guess I do at that, sir. No, I guess you'd call me an inventor."
"Oh, you'll have to excuse my grandfather. He's apt to say almost anything that comes into his head."
"Got something to do with ships, huh?"
Yes, I was told about this painting. That's as authentic a picture of a Jap battleship as can be found anywhere in New York."
"You ever see one?"
"A good many, sir. I was in the Navy."
"Honorable discharge?"
"Yes."
"You married?"
"Grant."
"Oh, I'm not." "Oh,
you'll have to excuse us, Mr....
Hodge. Paul Hodge."
"Well, Mr. Hodge, I'm afraid you might think my grandfather has overstepped all the usual bounds of courtesy. I'm terribly sorry."
"Oh, no, not at all. It's perfectly all right."
"Now, never you mind, Irene. I like this young fella. I was just going to ask him to come to your apartment for tea this afternoon."
"Oh, but Grant..."
"Yes, you two young folks ought to know one another."
"Oh, now..."
"She sets out some mighty tasty coffee cake. How about it?"
"Well, Ed baited you there. Noel, can you come up with the names that he was looking for?"
"Well, I hope I can. Alex Scorby is easy to get.
Mm-hmm.
The down east accent, I suppose, has got to be Parker Fennelly
because
he's been doing it and still doing it. Am I right?"
"That's correct."
"And I have a hunch, you didn't ask me about this, but I wouldn't be surprised if Virginia Gilmore was doing the girl."
I bet you're right on that, too. Very good. You get 100%.
"Well, maybe, because I'm not sure about her."
"When looking for that new car, may we suggest that you come to the Barrett Mutual Savings Bank?" "No. The Big B does not sell new or used cars, but it does help people to buy them. Chances are that you didn't know that the Barrett Mutual Savings Bank will make you a car loan at low, low rates. Before buying that new car, call any one of our four convenient offices for information. But wait, that's not all. You will need another car when this one wears out. And the Big B has a plan for that, too. When you finish with your new car loan, keep on making the payments into a Burt Mutual Savings account, where you will earn big, big dividends with no effort at all. Savings rates range from 5 to 6%, depending on the plan you choose. But whatever the plan, the next car you buy will be paid for by your Burt Mutual Passbook. So don't wait. Drop in at any office of the Burt Mutual Savings Bank for your new car loan, or to make that monthly payment on your old car loan, Barrett Mutual Savings Bank.
Hello, Noel Gerson. Let's talk about the Lone Ranger.
They had a very sharply defined format for the show. Fran Stryker, who owned and produced it, knew precisely what he wanted and the way he wanted it. And you wrote only within that absolutely rigid formula. The most obvious things, of course, was, for example, that the Lone Ranger never became really personally involved with any of the characters in this week's episode. He had no romantic interest, naturally. He spoke the King's English at all times. He was as pure in heart as he was in mind. And all of this was timed precisely, and if you didn't do it precisely as Stryker wanted it, you got the script thrown back into your teeth to do again.
Which the writer didn't care to do.
But which he did because he wanted to get paid.
That's right.
Well, of course, there was another very famous show you did at that time called the Ford Theater, which essentially adapted plays, mostly stage plays, for radio. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the technique of adapting a play from a visual medium into the medium of radio, where the ear was the only instrument that you could use.
Yes, well, the Ford Theater, of course, was one of the so-called class shows of the air, like Cavalcade, like the Celanese Theater that I so enjoyed doing for Hal James for a couple of years. Some of these were the good shows, the prestige shows with big orchestras in the pits, with name actors from Broadway and Hollywood, good actors with good directors, and you really tried. Well, now, as to the technique in them, obviously for a one-dimensional medium such as radio is, in a soap opera, if you were in a hurry to introduce a new character, we used to have a running gag that you would introduce a character by saying, "Oh, here comes my mother, Mrs. Jones." Well, now, obviously, on a good program, you didn't do it. When you had as much as 2 hours as you had in Celanese, it was a very simple thing to do because the original playwright had dandy exposition written into his own initial dialogue. But nevertheless, you had to set your characters in a way that to let the audience visualize them. You usually handled this through narration. And only when there was going to be an action scene in which the visual element came in very strongly, there you might have to break it with some kind of clues in narration, or if necessary, maybe throw in a little dialogue, as little as possible, to help the listener to visualize what was going on. Well, now, if you've got a big fight going on between two characters, and this fight lasts for 3 minutes, and they're smashing furniture, and they're knocking each other all around a studio set, there's only one way to handle that. You do not adapt that play for radio, or...
Well, we're about to hear an excerpt from the Ford Theater, and you certainly wrote a great many of those. Ed, where does this take us to?
A marvelous play. This is the front page, one of my favorites.
Heck and MacArthur's front page?
Yes, and I think this goes by the rule you said, that the dialogue is probably just taken as it was from the original script. And it does have a few famous people in it, including John Larkin, who plays the role of Hildy Johnson.
This is the Ford Theater, a full hour of radio drama. Our play this afternoon is the famous Broadway and motion picture hit, The Front Page.
What happened?
I'll tell you what happened. Hildy Johnson quit.
What do you mean, quit? He's a fixture on the Examiner. He goes with the Woodward.
All right, but I'm telling you, Hildy's quitting those papers and getting married.
I don't believe it. Anyway, I know that managing editor of his, Walter Burns. He'll do anything to keep Hildy. He'll stop that marriage if he has to kidnap Hildy at the altar.
The Ford Theater, presented by the Ford Motor Company, makers of Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury cars, and Ford trucks, farm tractors, and motor coaches. In the past three generations, millions of Americans have learned to rely on Ford products. For three generations, Ford has led the way in the development of more dependable, more economical transportation. Today, in the third generation, more than 8 million Americans prefer Ford products. They know from experience you can depend on Ford. As spokesman for the Ford Theater, may we present the distinguished playwright, producer, and actor, co-author of State of the Union and Life with Father, Howard Lindsay.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today, we are about to hear a rip-roaring story about newspaper men, Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur's celebrated play, The Front Page. When Gilbert Seldes undertook to adapt The Front Page for the Ford Theater, he was faced with having to crowd the fast and furious action of the original three-act drama into the restricted compass of 60 minutes of radio time. So, you see, we've not a moment to lose. In fact, even as I speak, the telephone bells are ringing impatiently in the press room of the Chicago Criminal Courts building. It is the eve of Chicago's last hanging. The condemned man has finished his last supper, and the reporters have gathered to cover his final hours on earth.
Press room, McHugh speaking. No, Hildy Johnson ain't here. Yeah, I'll tell him to call you. Oh, hiya, Frank. Come on in here and get some of these phones. Between a hanging and a wedding, I'm going nuts.
Well, who's getting married?
Hildy Johnson.
You mean he's getting hanged, don't you?
No, this is on the level, Frank. Hildy, quit.
What do you mean, quit? He's a fixture on the Examiner. He goes with the Woodward.
All right, but that's what happened. I'm telling you, Hildy's quitting those papers and getting married.
I don't believe it. Anyway, I know that managing editor of his, Walter Burns. He'll do anything to keep Hildy. He'll stop that marriage if he has to kidnap Hildy at the altar. What's that?
They're trying out the gallows for the hanging. Most of the boys are down in the courtyard watching it.
Who's the candidate tonight?
Earl Williams.
Who's that?
Weren't you here when the Williams case broke? The guy that was sleeping in the park. When the cop woke him up, he grabbed the cop's revolver and let him have it. Imagine killing a cop in Chicago.
Oh, that one. I thought they decided he was crazy.
Any guy's crazy that kills a cop in an election year.
Say, where is Hildy Johnson?
Search me. He hasn't shown up all night.
You mean there's going to be a hanging without Hildy Johnson?
Guess so.
Don't seem legal. Say, that's the biggest, blackest desk I ever saw. Whose is it?
Belongs to a hypochondriac named Bensinger from the Tribune. He's got it full of pills and gargles. Oh, this is him now.
Hi, McHugh.
Hello, Bensinger. This is Frank Endicott of the Post.
Hello, Endicott.
Hi, Bensinger. Fine desk you got there.
Hmm. Would be a nice desk if these bums around here wouldn't use it for a city dump. Look at that. Half a sandwich, stale glass of beer, and two old shirts. Newspaper men.
Just young boys at heart, that's us.
City desk. This is Bensinger. Here's the latest on the Earl Williams hanging. The condemned man ate a hearty dinner. Well, sure, I got the menu. Mock turtle soup, chicken pot pie, hash brown potatoes, combination salad, and pie a la mode.
Make mine the same.
No, no coffee.
I was afraid it would keep him awake.
Well, so long, fellas.
Hey, wait a minute. Where are you going?
Oh, I thought I'd look around.
You're a double-crossing liar.
Why don't you get your own news for a change?
You mean work at it? What do you think we are?
Sheriff speaking. Yes, Mr. Mayor. No, you needn't worry about that, Mr. Mayor. Not a chance. No, no reprieve. No, the governor's gone fishing. Went this afternoon. Oh, we'll swing Earl Williams, all right. Thanks, Mr. Mayor. We'll be on top next Tuesday. Bye, Mr. Mayor. Send the boys and the newspapers in.
Well, hi.
Hello, Sheriff. Hi.
Now, boys, you're always riding me. Look at this. Sheriff Hartman has just put 200 more relatives on the payroll to prevent an outbreak of violence at the execution of Earl Williams. Now, that ain't nice, boys. This is an honest administration.
Hooray for Pinky Hartman.
And don't call me Pinky.
Look, Mr. Sheriff, my paper has always treated you square. Now, a certain party over at the paper is asking you a favor. How about hanging this guy at 5 o'clock instead of 7 so we can make the city edition?
Oh, now, Bensinger, you can't hang a fella in his sleep just to please a newspaper.
No, but you got the hanging postponed twice, so it comes just 3 days before election.
I had nothing to do with them retrieves. That was the governor.
Yeah, how do you know there won't be another reprieve tonight?
How do you know this alienist won't find him insane?
Insane? That guy's as sane as I am.
Saner. Ah, gentlemen of the press, good evening, you bum.
What are you doing
Hildy,
here?
Hildy, Walter Burns wants you.
Gee, look, he's carrying a cane.
Hildy Johnson, you get out of here. No one invited you to this press conference.
How are you, Sheriff? Who's been getting your goat?
No one gets my goat. Only you and that big-mouthed Walter Burns think you're running Chicago. Well, you go right back and tell Walter Burns that the examiner don't get no more than two tickets for this execution.
Why, you silly shrimp. If I wanted to, I'd take six guests to your hanging party and sit in the box. See, it just happens I don't want to go.
Yeah? And why don't you want to go?
I don't want to go because I am no longer a member of the working press. As of today, Mr. Sheriff, I have resigned.
You're kidding.
It can't be.
Why didn't you tell Walter Burns you resigned? He's been calling you all night in the press room.
I didn't tell Walter Burns I resigned because I didn't want him to interfere with my life.
What are you going to do, Hildy?
Well, first, I'm taking a train to New York.
And you're going to wear a top hat and work for the New York Times. Say it ain't so, Hildy.
Second, I'm going to get married.
To someone that knows you?
That can't be.
And third, I am going into the advertising business. 150 smackers a week.
You mean a month?
150 a week. So goodbye, you broken-down wage slaves, when you're crawling up fire escapes and getting kicked out of front doors and eating Christmas dinner in a one-armed joint. Remember your old pal, Hildy Johnson.
An adaptation of Front Page from Ford Theater. In your opinion, Noel, what was the great attraction, the biggest advantage of writing for radio, aside from the money?
Well, you took the very words out of my mouth.
I saw it coming.
There was an awful lot of money in radio. Most radio gave you very little personal satisfaction as you listened to it. What it did do, however, for anybody who was seriously interested in writing for a living, it gave you a flexibility and it sharpened you to the point that for those of us who went on into television, and I was fortunate I went beyond that into books, it was the most marvelous training ground in the world, and you were extraordinarily well paid while doing it. I mean, I could go on from there to say that, gee, wasn't this wonderful, the entertainment we all gave to millions, and so forth. But let us eschew that and keep it strictly personal and say that it was the most marvelous training ground for a writer.
Noel Gerson, thank you very much for appearing with us tonight on the Golden Age of Radio. This is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889. The program was engineered by Bob Sherrago and was produced and edited by Brian Hartnett. This is Al Terzi.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
Rinse-O white and Rinse-O bright.
Broadcasting from New York City, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and
a dancing program from the Paradise Restaurant in the Great White Way of Manhattan, New York City. Played by Glenn Miller and his orchestra.